In hindsight, all great ideas are obvious. The big ideas of today will become market-leading companies in the near future, reimagining every sector of the economy for the better. Climate, healthcare, food, transportation, housing, energy, and more. Welcome to Obvious Ideas, a podcast exploring the transformation of the fundamental building blocks of life and society. I'm Andrew Beebe, Managing Director at Obvious Ventures. This is episode 3 of our 8-part series on climate. We're digging into the biggest opportunities for founders and professionals in any industry to tackle our climate crisis. Today, I'm speaking with Jason Jacobs, the creator and host of My Climate Journey, a podcast that demystifies climate change and helps people make a difference. Before diving into climate, Jason's entrepreneurial background included being founder and CEO of Runkeeper, which was acquired by ASICS. In this episode, Jason shares the unusual backstory behind the MCJ Collective Climate Tech Fund and reveals through lines from his conversations with over 200 climate, science, and technology leaders. Jason, welcome. Thanks so much for coming on this podcast.
Andrew, thank you for having me. And I look forward to any time we get to spend time together. So the fact that it's being recorded is a bonus, but just great to catch up.
Obviously, this is very full circle for the two of us, because how many years ago was it that you had recently sold your company, Runkeeper, and you came to me very politely asking for sort of advice on how to dive into this climate investing world, and you described creating a community and sort of maybe doing some investing and maybe starting a company. You just weren't sure, but you had so many incredible ideas. So maybe you could fast forward for us and tell everyone what that journey was like and how far you've come in terms of what you built.
So after selling the company, I wanted to work on something purposeful, was super concerned about climate. And I got a few months down the path of building this company in an unrelated space. And literally every time there was more climate bad news, it would just send me into this tailspin. So I realized climate was where I needed to be. And instead of coming in saying, I'm going to do X and figure out how to apply it to climate, I said, I don't know what the heck I'm going to do, but I know climate's where I'm going to be, and I'm not going to focus on what I'm going to do. I'm just going to focus on learning about the problem and the potential paths forward. And for starters, it was just me out talking to people, reading and learning. And then I didn't set out to have a podcast, but as I talked to those people, they would say, keep me posted on your progress. I started sending regular updates. And every time I sent a new update, I would call out areas I was looking to tackle next and key learnings and questions I was wrestling with. I get more introductions. Distribution list would grow. They saw that I was ahead and covering all this ground. So they would go to me for advice. And I'd say, like, look, I don't know what you should do. I'm still trying to figure out what I should do, but I wish you could learn all the things I'm learning and hear from all the people I'm talking to. So that's why the pod started. So it wasn't to help people. It was just to build a knowledge repository. And I thought it'd be fun to kind of build a pod like a product. It would give me something to build. So people were binging on the pod. My inbox was filling up with people that were getting great value from the show, and they were strategic and came from really diverse backgrounds. And they didn't know each other, and they were longing for a peer group. So that's why we set up a Slack community, just because we thought, well, these people are really engaged and they're on the similar journeys, but they're not talking. And wouldn't that cross-pollinization be helpful to them? And if we were a convener, maybe it would be strategic for us selfishly. So we just set up a Slack room, and it kind of took on a life of its own. That was 3.5 years ago. And it's been this kind of weird organic ride where essentially I never got around to figuring out what I'll ultimately do, because the journey kind of became the destination. And now I just keep putting one foot in front of the other, and it's leading to bigger and better things, but started out in a really unscripted, kind of serendipitous way.
So you also started a venture fund. Tell us about that, and how many investments have you made?
I mean, the weird thing is that it's all the same. It's all My Climate Journey, which has now been shortened to MCJ Collective, where there's three pillars. There's a media arm, and that has the podcast and the newsletter today. There's the member community, and that has the 2,000 members and meetups and book clubs and study groups and knowledge sharing and hiring. And then there's the capital arm. It's like this flywheel of content, community, and capital. And that capital today consists of a couple of rolling funds, an early stage index-like fund that writes small checks into a lot of climate tech companies, really just the best climate tech companies out there across sectors, stages, and geographies. It's backed 55 companies in 5 quarters. And then we have an opportunity fund that's around the same size that's writing much fewer, more concentrated checks, primarily, but not exclusively, in select follow-ons from the core fund portfolio, and select meaning we spend time with all these companies and we get to know how they're doing and which ones are breaking out. And we also, where we're able to be helpful, we get access even when the rounds are otherwise oversubscribed, and we can plow money in, which we've started doing to select companies in the portfolio. But it all kind of serves the same thing, which is helping these three profiles that we serve: the explorer who's looking to transition from a career somewhere else into a career in climate, investors who are looking to allocate capital in this direction, and founders, entrepreneurs who either are actively building companies or who aspire to in the space.
Awesome. So let's do some basic table setting here. How do you define climate tech today?
Probably a lot broader than a lot of other people in the space, because a lot of the traditional climate investors define it by carbon and gigatons and how much carbon is either getting not emitted or pulled out of the sky. And I mean, carbon and GHGs, which means greenhouse gas emissions, are super important. For us, we take a little broader view, because if we look at the global economy, essentially, there's a lot of good that's come from the Industrial Revolution and globalization, but essentially, emissions are pollution, and there's been no cost to dumping a bunch of pollution in the atmosphere. And so essentially, the pollution, or as the climate world calls it, the externality, isn't factored in. There's no price on it. And so there's no incentive to manage how much you're pumping into the sky. And that's not sustainable. But we essentially need to rewire our global economy in a way that factors in the externalities and is more in harmony with the planet we rely on to sustain life, humans and otherwise, and more in harmony with each other as it relates to equality and justice. Food and ag, industrial processes, carbon markets, climate risk, insurance, city planning, transportation, like everything needs to change. And so from our standpoint, for example, if there were a company that were telling compelling stories and helping educate and inspire people to action, well, how many GHGs is that directly responsible for removing from the sky or reducing? That'd be a hard thing to measure. But that's a climate company, right? And so we take a broader purview. Today, we call it the blog post test, where we write a blog post announcing the investment. Can we puff our chest out and feel proud of the financial impact it can have if it works? Like, can it get really big and make a lot of money? And then same thing on the impact standpoint. We think GHGs, while important, is too narrow for our thesis.
That's really helpful. And I think you threw in another piece there, which is that you're also gaming toward an outcome of strong financial returns. So from the capital standpoint, that's one of your drivers as well, right? You're looking for long-term sustainable businesses, not just in sustainability, but in financial outcomes.
From our standpoint, our initial LPs, if we're talking about investments, we have 300 something LPs, and it's all strategic individuals who are, and it's individuals and strategic and mission aligned and climate motivated. Now, it's not philanthropy. They're not looking to set money on fire. They expect a financial return, but it's not their primary motivator. They want to get closer to the action. They want to figure out how to mobilize their capital and time effectively. They think there's money to be made and they want to help. Like, they just think it's an important problem. Directionally, though, if we want to grow our assets under management over time, it's probably not going to be with individuals forever. And so we'll have to start thinking about, if we do take in more institutional capital, what does that look like? And how important is climate motivated? Is it concessionary? Well, no, we expect financial returns. Well, then should mission matter when it comes to the capital choices you take? Like, I don't have a good answer for that yet, but we are a for-profit firm. We expect to be measured by returns, but it isn't profit that motivates us, it's impact. We know, though, that not only will we not have the right to grow our capital under management and grow our resources over time, but we won't even earn the right to stay around if we don't put up the goods and deliver returns. So we need to put up the goods and deliver returns. And we also believe that in order for something to have impact, it needs to have scale. So, I mean, that's our thesis. And they don't always go together, but we look for the opportunities where they do go together.
Jason, awesome. Let's switch over to the explorer piece of this and the people that you have helped show a path, show a climate journey for themselves to come over into climate tech professionally. A lot of people have sort of nights and weekends views. They're reading up, they're listening to your podcast. Let's say I'm a product manager at Google or Meta, and it's become less interesting to me, or I'm less aligned with the values or vision of that company. How do you help those people transition if they don't come with a earth sciences or engineering degree from a more traditional background thinking about the engineering of the planet?
Well, if you take me, I gave myself permission to just learn without a destination in mind. And granted, I was in a position where I didn't need a salary, like you said, but even if I wasn't, it could be nights and weekends. It could be on my commute to work. It could be replacing whatever Netflix series I'm binging on with more climate-related content. But you don't have to start with gory stuff that makes your eyes glaze over. Like, pick a lane that's intellectually interesting to you and enjoyable to learn about, and just pull a thread and then pull a different thread. You can focus on literally anything because it touches everything. There's one woman, she started out working in big tech when she graduated college, and she knew she ultimately wanted to work on climate. And nights and weekends, she started volunteering to be a community manager for a community in one subset of the climate world. And then that ended up leading to a job in a company that was founded by one of the community organizers. And now she works in climate for a living. There's another woman, Nicole Kellner, who wanted to work in climate. And as she was dabbling and figuring it out, she started making climate art. Right. And it's like, well, the wonks would have never said that an artist could have an impact on climate, but she's inspiring tons of people. And if she wanted to, she could probably make a living doing it. So it's like, it can be a lane that you couldn't necessarily predict going in. You got to give yourself time and space to experiment and try different things. And some people are going to want to jump straight to having a job and then pivoting from there to a different job. And other people are going to want to get a more holistic view first. I'm in the latter camp, but not everybody works the same.
Yeah. I find that there's a lot of fear and trepidation, particularly because of the clean tech 1.0 perception of a bubble being burst about 12 years ago, people being a little bit anxious about leaving that cushy job behind and jumping in head first. What I think we've seen now is that it's really one of the more de-risked areas, in the sense that if you come into climate tech today, there are going to be job after job after job in a very resilient way. Is that what you're seeing out there?
Well, a few points. One, yes. But another point I want to make is that the innovation cycles continue to get more compressed over time, meaning that the safe path, there is no safe path, right? So everything has risk. It's just a different kind of risk. And it's just about assessing fit. But like, if you're joining a climate startup, it's not more risky or less risky than joining any startup. Startups are risky, right? If you're staying in a big company, like, big companies aren't safe. Big companies just have a different set of risks than startups. There's not just risk associated with going for it. There's risk associated with not going for it, because if you feel in your gut that you should be going for it and you let fear stop you, you might look back on your deathbed and wonder what if you went for it and have regrets. And regrets are a risk. One lens I look through is just, yes, I need to feed my family. Don't get me wrong. But like, if I try this and it doesn't work and I go get another job somewhere else, like, is this an important enough problem that if I move the ball forward and help with the problem, even if my particular venture isn't successful, then would I be proud of that? And if the answer is yes, then it's like, then there is no losing in that scenario. There might be outcomes that are more financially beneficial than others. But if you're working on a worthy problem, it makes it a lot easier to digest the prospect that it might not work out.
If you're in a big company, do you think that people in these massive companies, or say oil and gas companies, do you think that there's a way to stay in those companies and really move the ball forward? Or do you generally really push for hitting the escape valve button or the parachute and jumping and going for it?
Oh, I think both paths can be equally as fertile ground. I mean, look at the, what was the name of that organization that got a couple climate activist board members onto Exxon's board?
Engine One.
Yeah, Engine One. I mean, conventional wisdom was, if you want to squeeze fossil fuel companies, you divest, right? But they didn't divest. They loaded up on shares so that they could play more of an activist role and have more leverage on the organization. There's so much that can be done. And I would never say the only way to do it is to leave. And I would never say the only way to do it is to do a startup. I think that it's just a little pebble in a big sea of roles to play.
Jason, you've talked to hundreds of different people about their climate journeys. Are there any sort of through lines that you've perceived throughout that set of conversations?
For people that stick with it, and not everyone does, eventually they find success and their journeys look very different from each other. And you kind of have to give yourself the leeway to leave room for serendipity and just the patience and the internal fortitude to stick it out. And if you do and you want it badly enough, you will find a spot and you will be able to feed your family and make a living, and you will be able to put climate front and center in a way that energizes you and you feel like you bring valuable skills to the table. It just might not necessarily look like what you thought it would coming in.
What are the areas that you've been most excited about, you know, the most fertile ground that you see lately that people could jump on board? Is it carbon capture and sequestration or direct air capture? What's hot on your plate right now?
Our thesis is that everything needs to change and that we're just going to be undoing knots and getting more resources pointed in the right direction, but almost like a 100,000 piece jigsaw puzzle versus like, here's the three areas that we're excited about.
As an example, Jason, carbon markets are an area that you spend a lot of time on. What do you think about that?
There's so many different stakeholders and things that need to change and opportunities and problems. And I mean, you could be a project developer. You could build a marketplace. You could help big companies to better understand their footprints so they know like how much they need to offset. You could rethink how the certifications get done. But you could literally point to any area: insurance, climate risk, or regenerative ag, or how crops actually get made, like using SynBio to make more durable crops that are better carbon sinks. Like, there's so much. And you could point at any area and double click on it and fund 50 different companies in that area, which is one of the reasons why I love this problem so much, that it's just so all encompassing and so systems in nature, where it's very interrelated, almost like a rainforest.
Come on in. The water is great. I think that's basically the message you got. Okay, Jason, we always end with the following question. In hindsight, all great ideas are considered obvious. So come 2030, what are we going to look back at as an obvious idea that today seems totally crazy?
I think the obvious idea is that by bringing about the transition to a more clean, sustainable, and just economy, that it will not involve, like, will there be certain industries that get compressed while other industries grow? Yes. Will there be certain reskilling that needs to get done? Yes. Will the competitive landscape change? Will there be winners and losers? Yes, right? So you can find it at the individual level and say, well, this company is not going to do as well, or this industry is not going to do as well. And like, that's all true, as with any change, but there's going to be so much opportunity, and overall our quality of life, I believe, and I'm no expert, but I've, you know, talked to hundreds of people and been reading a lot and continue to learn every day. But I believe way more than I did coming in 3.5 years ago, that there's an optimistic path forwards where we will have more abundance, more equality, and more innovation than we've had before. I am excited about the future. Like, all the dread, and look, it's urgent. We have real problems. We need to address them. They shouldn't be taken lightly. We shouldn't be apathetic about it or take our foot off the, you know, I was going to say take our foot off the gas, but I'm optimistic, I'm excited, and I think our future is going to be better than our past.
Love it. All right. So by solving the climate crisis, the world's going to be a much happier, more egalitarian, cleaner, safer place.
By taking the greatness that came from the Industrial Revolution and rewiring it so that we can still benefit from the powerful growth and market forces and economic engine, but do so in a way that's more in harmony with the planet we rely on and with each other.
Amazing, Jason. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, Andrew.
That was Jason Jacobs, the creator and host of My Climate Journey. Next week on the show, we speak with Tony Fadell, the climate tech investor who previously led the teams that brought us the iPod, the iPhone, and the Nest thermostat.
Electric cars can be sexy, right? We know that. They can go faster, da da da. But let's talk about the transmission lines and the distribution networks. Let's talk about where all the lost heat is in industrial processes. It doesn't sound glamorous, but all of these things are incredibly important for the planet.
Obvious Ideas is produced by Obvious Ventures in partnership with Pod People. Obvious invests in purpose-driven founders reimagining trillion-dollar industries. To learn more about us and where we invest, head to obvious.com. Special thanks to our production team, Gabe Kleiman, Aniko Steffen, and Emily Brady from Obvious, and the team at Pod People, Rachel King, Amy Machado, Emily Shaw, Madison Lusby, and Jason Mack. I'm Andrew Beebe. Thanks for listening.